The Eight Immortals Travel East, Chapter 54.
We're going to see how this Ming Dynasty text gives us a profound look at institutional arrogance, the concept of restorative justice.
Which is super relevant today, by the way.
It's all relevant. And ultimately, we're going to see how these incredibly powerful, supposedly untouchable gods eventually end up meddling in the everyday, mundane lives of regular mortals.
It's quite the journey.
It really is. So I want to jump right into the inciting incident here, because the sheer scale of the overreaction is fascinating to me.
Okay, let's do it.
We start with the celestial authorities reacting to this chaos on Earth. We have Marshal Zhao, who acts as a sort of heavenly enforcer.
Yeah, he's like the cosmic muscle.
Exactly. He limps back into the heavenly court to report to the Jade Emperor, who is the supreme ruler of the Taoist pantheon. And Zhao is delivering a damage report that sounds apocalyptic.
Oh, he essentially brings the absolute worst possible news a cosmic ruler could hear. He confirms that Mount Tai has indeed been pushed into the East Sea.
Just a whole mountain.
Right. And the ocean is physically being filled up with debris. He reports widespread murder, arson, and he claims that a group known as the Eight Immortals are running completely rampant.
Which is a huge accusation.
It is. And crucially, Zhao makes a point to emphasize that his own wrist was injured in the fray.
His poor wrist.
Right, exactly. And he adds that the Dragon King of the EC is currently being hunted down.
Okay, I want to pause on the Dragon King for a second. Because this guy's underwater palace is actively being crushed by a mountain.
Yeah, his living room is full of rocks.
The text says he is in an absolute panic, sending this emergency plea to the Jade Emperor. But he's also begging the Buddha for troops at the exact same time.
Which is fascinating.
It is. He's hedging his bets across entirely different religious pantheons.
Well, the Dragon King's panic actually reveals the incredibly complex overlapping jurisdictions of this mythological universe.
Right.
Think of it like a desperate local governor appealing to both the national military and an international peacekeeping coalition simultaneously.
That's a great analogy.
Because in the framework of the Dong Yuji, you have the Taoist Celestial Court headed by the Jade Emperor. That functions as the primary administrative government of the cosmos.
Okay, got it.
But then you also have the Buddhist hierarchy, which operates almost like an independent, parallel spiritual authority.
And the Dragon King doesn't care about these jurisdictional boundaries at all.
Not even a little bit. His house is filled with a mountain. He's blasting out distress signals to every single department head in the universe, just praying someone sends the riot squad.
And the Jade Emperor receives this distress signal, sees the damage report from Marshal Zhao, and he completely loses his mind.
Oh, he goes nuclear.
He does. He immediately deploys Marshal Guan and Marshal Wen with 200,000 heavenly troops.
Which is already a massive army.
Right. And if that wasn't enough, he orders Marshal Ma and the injured Marshal Zhao to back them up with another 200,000 troops.
It's staggering.
So we have 400,000 heavily armed soldiers marching to deal with eight individuals. I mean, that ratio is absolutely absurd. Let's unpack this for a second.
Let's do it.
Because to me, this sounds exactly like a corporate escalation.
Oh, for sure.
You have the first middle manager, Marshal Zhao, who completely failed to handle a local dispute, got a bloody nose, and went crying to the CEO.
The CEO being the Jade Emperor.
Yes. And now the CEO is wildly overreacting by sending in the riot squad, 400,000 troops. It just feels like a massive overcompensation.
Well, it is entirely disproportionate, and that is precisely the author's point. The Jade Emperor's anger bypasses any form of actual investigation and leaps straight to an overwhelming military deployment.
Right. There's no fact-finding mission here.
Exactly. It highlights a recurring theme in classical literature regarding supreme authority, you know. Absolute power often responds to embarrassment or disruption with an absolutely terrifying show of force.
So the goal isn't to solve the problem.
No, the goal isn't surgical precision or finding out why a mountain was moved in the first place. Mm. The goal is shock and awe.
Wow.
He wants to reestablish the hierarchy and prove that the heavenly court is not to be trifled with.
Oh, wait, look at who wrote the initial report. Marshal Zhao was the guy initially sent down to handle the dispute, right?
He was, yeah.
He completely fails, gets his wrist bruised, and runs back to the palace. Is it possible he's intentionally framing the Eight Immortals as these mindless terrorists just to cover up his own incompetence as a mediator?
That is a critical reading of Zhao's character, actually. By using inflammatory words like murder and arson, he deliberately strips away all the context regarding why the immortals are upset.
Right. He makes them sound completely unreasonable.
Exactly. Because if the immortals had a valid grievance, well, it would mean Zhao failed his primary objective to mediate the situation peacefully.
Oh, that makes total sense. So he's covering his own tracks.
Yes. So instead of admitting a diplomatic failure, he frames it as an unprovoked rebellion. And it forces us to ask a deeply uncomfortable question about institutional response.
Which is?
How often does the framing of a conflict by the very first responder dictate an unnecessarily violent reaction from the top?
Oh, wow.
The Jade Emperor is responding to Zhao's bruised ego, not the reality on the ground.
The guy who holds the pen controls the army.
Absolutely.
And now the drums of war are beating. We have 400,000 celestial troops marching through the sky.
The text describes the visual as covering the sky and fields with warriors. It's an apocalyptic image designed to induce total terror.
But here is where the narrative shifts gears entirely, which I love. We zoom in on the generals leading this massive armada.
Right, Guan and Wen.
We transition from this macro-level military strategy to a surprisingly intimate conversation between Marshal Guan and Marshal Wen as they march.
It's a great scene. Despite their explicit orders from the furious Jade Emperor to essentially obliterate the Eight Immortals, Marshal Guan turns to Marshal Wen and introduces a massive caveat.
He pumped the brakes.
It really does. Quan states that regardless of their orders, he wants to determine right from wrong first. He is actively applying critical thinking to a direct, unquestionable military command from the supreme ruler of the universe.
I have to say, this totally subverts my expectation of what a mythical warrior is supposed to be.
How so?
Well, you have these terrifying celestial generals with an endless sea of troops behind them. But instead of hyping themselves up with war cries, they are having a quiet, incredibly rational conversation about their coworkers' anger management issues.
It's true. It reveals a profound level of emotional and political intelligence on Guan's part.
Right. Guan is basically saying, look, Zhao lost because he's a hothead. It's surprisingly rational.
He points out a basic logical inconsistency in Marshal Zhao's initial report. He tells Wen that if the Dragon King were entirely innocent in all of this, the highly respected Eight Immortals would not be acting this way.
Because they aren't just random villains.
Exactly. We have to remember who the Eight Immortals are in Chinese folklore. They aren't traditional stuffy bureaucrats of the Heavenly Court.
They're more like rebels, right?
Yeah. They're often depicted as these free-spirited populist figures. Former humans who attained immortality through Taoist practices. They drink, they wander the earth, they help the poor.
So they wouldn't just move a mountain for fun.
Right. Guan recognizes that they aren't random thugs. If they're pushing mountains around, something must have seriously provoked them.
Guan is basically diagnosing the situation in real time. He criticizes Zhao for being too aggressive during that initial visit, pinning the blame for the escalation entirely on Zhao's hot-headedness. So Guan suggests a radically different strategy to Wen. He says, courtesy before force. He wants to parley. But my question is, why bring 400,000 troops if your goal is courtesy?
Well, because Guan understands the mechanics of soft power.
Speak softly and carry a big stick.
Exactly. The army is the leverage that makes the courtesy meaningful. Furthermore, Guan makes an incredibly astute political prediction here.
Right. He sees the bigger picture.
He tells Wen that because the Eight Immortals are highly connected, meaning they have a vast network of relationships with other powerful deities across the cosmos, a mediator will inevitably step in to stop the fighting.
He knows he is walking into a political minefield.
He absolutely does. If he just marches in and slaughters the Eight Immortals, he risks angering half the pantheon of gods who consider them friends or disciples.
So he's anticipating a mediator before one even appears. That is staggering foresight. And it makes total sense when you look at the reaction on the ground.
What happens down there?
Well, Iron Crutch Lai, one of the Eight Immortals, sees this massive army darkening the sky. And he doesn't panic. And he doesn't immediately attack.
Which shows incredible restraint.
Right. He warns his peers not to underestimate the massive army, organizes a defensive stance, and immediately goes to Laozi for help.
So both sides are preparing for war. But the leaders on both sides are desperately looking for a diplomatic off-ramp.
They recognize that the systemic machinery of war has been turned on by an overreacting emperor, and they are trying to figure out how to shut it down from the inside without destroying each other.
Which brings us to the actual standoff. Guan's courtesy before force doctrine sets up a tense, formal parley.
Okay, set the scene for us.
Zhongli Quan and Lu Dongbin, representing the immortals, step out from their defensive lines to speak with Guan and Wen. And Guan doesn't accuse them. He simply asks why they resisted heaven.
And this is where we finally hear the other side of the story.
Yeah, the real story.
Zhongli explains their core grievance. First, he completely validates Guan's suspicion. He says Marshal Zhao refused to listen to reason and acted like a thug.
Vindicating Guan's theory completely.
Yep. Then Zhongli lays out the actual crimes committed by the Dragon King. He reveals that the Dragon King stole a crucial magical item from them, a jade tablet.
A huge deal in this mythos.
And worse, the Dragon King captured their friend, Lan Kaihe, locked him in a dark room, and used the massive aquatic armies of the ocean to bully the immortals.
So the immortals were essentially the victims of a localized underwater mafia boss.
Exactly.
They are laying out a clear case of grand theft, kidnapping, false imprisonment, and military overreach by the Dragon King.
It's a laundry list of crimes.
It is. They're operating on a very old, very human set of principles. Loyalty to their friend, grievance over stolen property, and the demand for restitution.
So pushing the mountain wasn't random.
No, they pushed a mountain into the sea as a measured, albeit geologically extreme, response to an unprovoked attack on their own.
Geologically extreme, I love that. And Guan is listening to all of this. The diplomacy is actually working. The facts are on the table.
They are so close to a resolution.
But then the entire structure of the parley just shatters. While Guan is actively negotiating, Marshals Ma and Zhao, the very guys who escalated this in the first place, launch a completely unauthorized, dishonorable sneak attack from the rear of the Immortals' formation.
It is a devastating betrayal of the truce.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, it fundamentally changes the genre of the text in a microsecond.
How do you mean?
Because the moment Ma and Zhao break that diplomatic seal, the immortals don't just fight back with swords and spells. They unleash their ultimate trump card.
Yes.
Suddenly, the great sage equal to Heaven Sun Wukong, the legendary Monkey King, bursts from the ranks of the immortals.
I was waiting for this. Wukong's entrance is legendary. The text specifically notes that he doesn't say a single word.
Not one syllable.
He doesn't state his lineage. He doesn't offer a formal challenge. He doesn't negotiate. He just bursts out and swings his iron cudgel.
And the result is terrifying. When Ma and Zhao try to block a strike from the Great Sage, the text notes casually that their celestial weapons instantly shatter into pieces.
Just shatter.
Yeah. They are completely and utterly outclassed.
Wow. Okay, so diplomacy completely breaks down because of this internal sabotage, and the sheer scale of the resulting destruction finally forces the universe's highest authorities to intervene.
They have no choice now.
We shift from a kinetic military battle to a tense arbitration. Iron Crutch Lai's early call for help pays off, and Laozi and the Buddha arrive on the scene.
And they arrive right at the critical moment, shouting for a ceasefire before the Great Sage can eradicate the rest of the heavenly host.
Thank goodness.
And shortly after, Guanyin, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, also arrives on a cloud. Though, importantly, the text notes she initially just comes over to watch the drama unfold.
I love this detail so much. The Bodhisattva of Compassion essentially pulls up with a bucket of popcorn to watch the universe tear itself apart.
It's hilarious.
Laozi and Buddha, who are the supreme enlightened beings of Taoism and Buddhism respectively, turn to Guanyin and ask her to mediate. But once the mediation actually starts, things bog down immediately. The Dragon King and the immortals just start yelling at each other again, repeating their grievances.
As expected.
And the highest, most enlightened beings in the universe, Laozi and Buddha, are absolutely useless in stopping it.
Their reactions during this arbitration are, honestly, a razor-sharp piece of philosophical satire.
Really? Tell me about that.
As the two sides scream at each other over kidnapped friends and stolen artifacts, the Buddha's only contribution is to occasionally close his eyes and say his mantra, Amitabha.
Just mumbling it.
Right. Yeah. And Laozi, the grand patriarch of Taoism, just sits there muttering, let it be, let it be.
I don't understand. These are the most powerful spiritual figures in the text. Why are they portrayed as so utterly conflict averse?
That's a critique.
They are basically sitting in lawn chairs, watching the world burn, mumbling, it is what it is. Why?
Well, to understand the satire, we have to look at the specific philosophical tenets they represent. Laozi represents the Taoist concept of Wu Wei.
Right, non-action.
Often translated simplistically as non-action, yes. But Wu Wei is actually about aligning oneself with the natural flow of the universe, acting without unnatural effort or forcing outcomes.
Okay, and the Buddha.
The Buddha represents a state of transcendent detachment from worldly desires and suffering. The text is critiquing the limits of these philosophies when applied to acute material crises.
Ah, because going with the flow doesn't work when the flow is a literal mountain crashing into your living room.
Precisely. The satire screams that transcendent detachment is a luxury. Reciting a mantra or letting the universe sort itself out is entirely useless when active warfare is vaporizing populations.
So true.
It requires Guanyin's active, pragmatic, hands-on intervention to actually untangle the mess. The text fix says Guanyin becomes extremely anxious or deeply frustrated by how useless her peers are being.
She's just over it.
Totally over it. She realizes that high-minded philosophy won't fix a broken system. So she steps up and takes full control, shifting us into a masterclass on conflict resolution.
And her first move isn't even to talk to the fighters, which is so interesting. She realizes something very perceptive. She can't just fix the problem in the battlefield. She has to manage the CEO first.
She understands that the Jade Emperor's anger is the engine driving the Celestial Army.
Right.
Even though the Emperor is objectively wrong to have escalated the conflict, he is still the supreme authority. He cannot be publicly humiliated or he will never recall his troops.
Ego management.
Exactly. So Guanyin brings Laozi and Buddha with her up to the Heavenly Court.
She brings the two old guys specifically for their institutional weight, right? Like bringing senior board members to talk down a rogue CEO.
That's exactly what it is. They approach the Emperor and carefully explain the actual timeline of events, validating that the Dragon King started the conflict by stealing the tablet and kidnapping Kaihi.
Setting the record straight.
Yes. They reframe the Immortals not as rebels, but as victims reacting to local corruption. And because Guanyin presents a united front of supreme deities, the Jade Emperor immediately defers to their judgment.
It's brilliant. She knows she has to make the supreme authority feel respected and informed before she can actually implement a fix on the ground. She gives the Jade Emperor an off-ramp that saves his pride.
Once she secures the political cover, she returns to the battlefield.
Okay, now she can deal with the actual combatants.
She addresses both the Immortals and the Dragon King, laying down the law that endless fighting only leads to mutual destruction. But she goes beyond empty platitudes.
She actually does something.
She takes tangible action. She demands the stolen 8-piece jade tablet from the Immortals, the very item the Dragon King stole that kicked off the whole mess, which the Immortals had managed to reclaim during the war.
Right. And here is where she performs what you called restorative justice in our notes. But honestly, I really struggle with this part.
Okay, let's unpack it.
Because Guanyin takes the 8 pieces of jade, selects the 2 most flawless, beautiful pieces, and hands them to the Dragon King as compensation for his 2 sons who were killed in the crossfire.
Yes, she does.
She tells him to look at the rocks and remember his kids. How is that restorative? It sounds incredibly insulting.
I see why you'd say that.
She's essentially giving a grieving father 2 shiny rocks to replace his dead children. It feels like a billionaire paying a parking fine after running someone over.
I completely understand that reaction.
Yeah.
And look, through a modern literal lens, it is an insulting trade. You cannot equate a human or dragon life with a piece of jewelry.
Right.
But we have to analyze this within the symbiotic economy of myth.
Mm-hmm.
In this literary context, these aren't just shiny rocks. They are artifacts of immense metaphysical weight and divine power.
Okay, so they're not just regular jade.
No, they're cosmic artifacts. Furthermore, Guanyin's act of selecting the flawless pieces is crucial. She is publicly, ritually validating the supreme value of his lost children.
So it's not a financial transaction. It's more like an acknowledgement of grief.
Exactly. Restorative justice in this mythological framework isn't about perfectly balancing a ledger. It's about ending the cycle of blood revenge.
Stopping the violence.
By offering this highly symbolic restitution, Guanyin is saying, your pain is recognized by the highest powers in the universe, and we are paying a supreme artifact to honor that loss.
And does it work?
The text says the Dragon King weeps, but he accepts the settlement. He accepts the acknowledgement.
He accepts the emotional settlement, but then he brings up a very practical, physical problem.
Right, the real estate issue.
He says, okay, I accept, but my palace is still crushed underneath Mount Tai. Where am I supposed to live? And this leads to my favorite visual in the entire text. It perfectly contrasts with Sun Wukong's violence earlier.
It really is a stunning moment. Guanyin's response is the ultimate display of enlightened power. She doesn't summon an army of engineers. She doesn't perform a flashy kinetic explosive spell.
No, none of that.
She simply reaches her hand out, dips one single finger into the churning ocean, hooks it under the base of Mount Tai, and casually lifts the entire mountain out of the sea, placing it gently back exactly where it originally belonged on land.
Cool. A tectonic plate moved with a single finger. Problem solved.
The contrast is key here.
Right, because the Monkey King used overwhelming physical force to destroy 100,000 lives in an instant. Guanyin uses an equally incomprehensible level of power, but she uses it entirely to restore, to heal, and to fix the environment without spilling a single drop of blood.
It perfectly encapsulates the difference between martial power, which destroys, and enlightened power, which restores order.
And the Jade Emperor loves this, right?
Oh, when the Jade Emperor sees this miraculous feat from his vantage point in heaven, he is absolutely amazed. He officially signs off on the peace treaty, and then he hands down the final judgments and punishments for the war.
Well, we have to talk about these punishments. Because let's tally the bill here. 100,000 troops are dead. 2 dragon princes are dead. A mountain was moved. The ocean was temporarily filled with rubble.
Massive cosmic destruction.
What is the ultimate penalty for the Dragon King and the 8 immortals who caused all of this mass death and destruction?
Well, the Jade Emperor looks at the situation, notes that Laozi and Buddha are mediating, and decides to be lenient.
Lenient.
He docks the Dragon King's pay for 1 year, and he gives the 8 immortals a minor demotion in celestial rank, strictly limited to 1 year. After 12 months, everything goes back to normal.
The text literally says, from then on, heaven and the deep were separated again and the world was at peace. The hierarchy is restored and the status quo is maintained. But, you know, the narrative doesn't stop there.
Right. There's a whole other half to this. With the cosmic war settled, chapter 54 executes a massive, jarring pivot. The perspective shifts drastically. Now that the 8 immortals have essentially served their 1-year suspension and are back in good standing, what do they do with their time?
They don't just sit around in heaven.
Yeah, they don't just sit around in the heavenly court. They go down to the dirt roads of the mortal realm, and they begin interacting with regular humans.
This final section is fascinating. It's essentially a compilation of earthly sightings, like mythological urban legends.
That's a great way to put it.
We transition from epic, high fantasy warfare involving millions of troops to a series of highly localized, intimate encounters. Let's walk through these, because they represent a massive shift in how we understand divine power. We go from gods moving mountains to gods doing street magic.
These stories frame the immortals as active, hidden participants in the mortal world, constantly testing or blessing everyday people. Let's look at the first encounter. It involves a Taoist selling interlocking wooden rings in a crowded market. The rings are carved, so they have no seams, but they form the shape of the Chinese character Lu.
Like the character for Lu Dongben.
Right. A local scholar looks at this puzzle, connects the clues, and realizes he's looking at the immortal Lu Dongben.
The scholar immediately bows down in the middle of the market and begs for spiritual salvation. He recognizes that he is standing in the presence of the divine. And what does Lu Dongben do? He playfully tricks the guy.
Classic trickster move.
He says, "Hey, someone behind you is calling me." And when the scholar turns his head to look, Lu Dongben vanishes into thin air.
This perfectly illustrates the playful trickster archetype common in Taoist lore. Lu Dongben isn't there to fight a war or issue commandments. He's there to amuse himself and remind mortals that magic exists just beneath the surface of the mundane.
But why not grant him salvation?
The scholar passed the intellectual test of recognizing the god, but perhaps his desire for immediate salvation was too eager or unearned. So Lu leaves him not with enlightenment, but with a magical memory, a puzzle that points toward the divine without fully revealing it.
The second encounter is where things get significantly darker and much more complex ethically. We have a family in Cheyenne who has just finished brewing a massive, expensive vat of soy sauce.
A very valuable commodity.
Suddenly, this crazy old man riding a donkey, who we understand is the immortal Zhang Guolao, rides straight into their house, completely uninvited.
He deliberately smashes their newly made, highly valuable vat of soy sauce, completely ruining it, and then casually rides away so fast they can't catch him.
Imagine the sheer rage of that family. This is their livelihood, their food, ruined by a vandal on a donkey. But when they go to clean up the mess...
When they inspect the broken shards of the vat, they find a dead, highly venomous snake at the very bottom of the ruined soy sauce.
Oh my God.
They realize instantly that the entire batch was fatally poisoned. If they had consumed it or sold it at the market, their entire family and perhaps their neighbors would have died.
So their anger instantly turns to profound shock and then gratitude. They try to chase the old man to thank him, but he's long gone. I want to dive deep into the ethics of this specific story, though.
Sure.
Why doesn't Zangwalo just tell them? Why not walk in and say, hey, there's a snake in your soy sauce. Let me help you fish it out. Why resort to property damage?
Well, because it operates as a powerful theological parable about human perspective and the limits of our understanding.
How so?
We mortals categorize events in our lives based on immediate, visible outcomes. To that family, a smashed vat is a financial disaster. It is a tragedy. But Zangwalo operates from a vantage point of cosmic omniscience. He sees the hidden poison that the family cannot. This encounter falls into the category of the unseen rescue. It challenges the reader to consider that what we often perceive as sudden misfortune, a run of terrible luck, or the violent destruction of our carefully laid plans might actually be a hidden divine intervention saving us from a toxic fate we simply couldn't perceive.
That is incredibly heavy. The old man breaks their stuff and leaves them to figure it out. It demands a radical level of trust in the chaos of life.
It really does.
It asks the reader to look at their own disasters and wonder if they are actually blessings in disguise.
Which leads directly into the third encounter, which is perhaps the most famous trope in global folklore. An explicit test of virtue.
The beggar on the bridge.
Exactly. We have a beggar with rotting, diseased feet lying on a bridge in the south. This is Li Tiguai, another of the eight immortals, in disguise.
And he's not just passively lying there. He's actively calling out to the people walking by, begging them to come over and rub his diseased feet to soothe his intense pain.
A very unpleasant request.
And for 3 entire days, countless people walk past him. Not a single person stops to help. The visual repulsion, the smell, the sheer inconvenience of it are too much for the mortals to handle.
After 3 days of being ignored, the beggar just starts laughing. He leaps up, hops onto a cloud, and flies away into the sky.
Revealing who he really is.
Yes, and the text makes it painfully clear. Anyone, literally anyone, who would overcome their visceral disgust and stop to help that beggar would have received divine salvation. They would have been elevated to the heavens. But every single person failed the test.
It makes you wonder how many people in that town watched him fly away and just drop to their knees in absolute crushing regret.
I'm sure there were many.
They literally walked past eternal salvation because it smelled bad and asked for 5 minutes of their time.
This story serves a vital theological purpose. It reminds mortals that the divine is imminent. It is hidden in plain sight.
It's all around us.
Furthermore, it asserts that the divine demands ethical behavior, boundless empathy, and open-mindedness from humans precisely when it is most difficult, unpleasant, and inconvenient to offer it.
It's easy to be good when it's easy.
Exactly. True virtue is not tested in a pristine temple while burning incense. True virtue is tested on a dirty bridge dealing with visceral human suffering. The gods disguise themselves as the marginalized to see how humanity treats its lowest members.
We have 2 final brief encounters that reinforce this idea of gods leaving their mark in subtle, almost artistic ways. Lu Dongbin returns, this time writing a beautiful, perfectly flowing poem using water instead of ink on a temple steel that the monks were reserving for famous calligraphers.
That's right.
He leaves a clue to his identity. He writes from Yuyang and vanishes, leaving behind a miraculous piece of watery art that refuses to dry.
It's a bit of divine graffiti designed to keep the temple monks humble. It shows that true artistic and spiritual expression doesn't need expensive ink or formal permission. It flows naturally from the Tao.
And then there's the final story.
Yes. The very last story involves a Taoist, again implied to be the ever-present Lu Dongbin, who approaches a dead, withered scholar tree in the courtyard of the Prince of Lu.
What does he do to it?
He puts a strange black pill into a hole in the dead wood, traces the character Lu on the ground, and leaves. The very next day, the dead tree is fully revived, green and flourishing.
A miracle of resurrection. But the text adds this bizarre, seemingly disconnected coda to the event. 3 days later, the prince is feeding a pregnant nun.
It's a very surreal shift.
She suddenly goes into labor, the prince puts her in a room, she gives birth, and in the middle of the night, both the mother and the newborn baby vanish completely into thin air.
Leaving behind nothing but 2 mouth characters, the Chinese character Ku written on the wall of the empty room.
And if you stack 2 Q characters on top of each other, what do you get? You get the character Lu.
Lu Dongbin strikes again.
The guy is utterly obsessed with wordplay and leaving his signature everywhere. But what does the dead tree and the pregnant nun actually mean? Because that feels very coded.
It touches on deep concepts of Taoist internal alchemy. The black pill reviving the dead tree represents the elixir of life, the power of the Tao to bring vitality to dead matter.
Okay, and the nun?
The pregnant nun giving birth and vanishing is a metaphor for spiritual rebirth, creating an immortal embryo within oneself that eventually transcends the physical body. Lu Dongbin is leaving these breadcrumbs, these living metaphors, scattered across the mortal realm for those wise enough to interpret them.
When you look at the pattern of these final encounters, you see a direct, profound message to the reader. We went from cosmic warfare, where the gods are these untouchable titans throwing mountains at each other, to these incredibly intimate, almost bizarre mortal encounters.
And these stories serve a distinct theological purpose that democratizes the miraculous. In the first half of the text, only the Jade Emperor, the Buddha, and Guanyin have any real agency.
Right, the mortals are just collateral damage.
Exactly. But in these final stories, the mortals possess all the agency. The scholar must choose to solve the puzzle. The family must choose how to react to the ruined soy sauce.
The pedestrians have to choose to rub the beggar's feet.
Yes. The cosmic order of the heavens may be settled by the elites, but the moral tests of humanity are ongoing, happening every single day in the streets and markets.